Blog Talk Radio.
Ah, the sound of that sound just does things for me. Good morning, everybody. This is Jeffrey Swartz.
Good morning.
Together with my compatriot, Brendan Berry, we are both professors of law at WMU Cooley Law School on Tampa Bay campus. And I'm supposed to say, and will say, as I say every time we start this show, that the opinions and the things that are said by Brendan and I are our opinions and our opinions alone. Sometimes we share them. But they are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School or its faculty, either individually or at large. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeffrey. How you doing? Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning.
Good morning to you both.
Yeah, good morning to Hezzy. Good morning to people. Good morning to anybody who's listening. And I know there's at least one guy who listens here down here in Tampa who's a person I know from teaching at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at University of South Florida. And I hear from him after every show. He sends me articles to read. He corrects me when he thinks I'm wrong. Good morning, Mr. Sklansky. Okay. And to Marilyn, who is probably listening, she's off with some of her friends on a little two-day jaunt having a girl's time, and I'm sure that she's listening. She tends to do that every morning, every Tuesday morning. So good morning to Marilyn. We start out, anybody you want to say hello to, Brendan?
No. Hi, Marilyn.
No? Okay.
Hi, Marilyn.
All right.
Okay, as he says, see, Marilyn, you're a very popular person. We start out the show each week with giving each of us about 5 minutes to spout off about something we're disturbed about. Usually it has to do with, you know, the law or Congress or whatever. My complaint is a completely different world, a total and complete different world than anything that we ever talk about, okay? So I'm not expecting any responses to this, okay? I have had an experience maybe a little over a week ago with a need to have to go to an emergency room. Now, I'm fine. I will be fine. But I went there with great concern, and I learned a lot after all these years about what the American medical system really is, and it was rather disconcerting. And so that, you know, I'll just tell you that I went to an emergency room at a hospital here in Tampa, and the first thing you need to know is that the only way you go to an emergency room is by way of fire rescue. Because if you come in with fire rescue, you go right to the front of the line. I mean, you just elbow your way right to the front of the line. If you have somebody drive you over there and drop you off, you're going to be in the waiting room for quite a while before you ever get in the back to see a doctor or anybody else. So I'm just trying to tell you that the best way to go, okay, is get chauffeured there by the people that you call on 911. Now, don't make a 911 call because you got a hangnail. But, you know, that's the first thing I would tell everybody. You got to take an ambulance, okay, or fire rescue. The second thing is that when I got there, I was amazed to find, first of all, COVID is here, but COVID really wasn't their problem. It's a huge emergency room at this particular hospital. They work in pods, and God knows how many rooms there are to a pod. And it's huge. I mean, they're big. Okay, remember, emergency room is a small area. I mean, big area. They don't have enough rooms for everybody. So what they've done is they take gurneys, you know, those beds with the uncomfortable mattresses that they wheel you around in. And they put them up against the wall. And then on the wall above the gurney, they have a piece of paper that has a room number on it. Your gurney is your room. And you stay in the hallway. Okay, the people lined up in the hallway. Okay? There clearly is a lack of personnel. Some of the personnel don't even know how to use the equipment that they have. They tried to interrogate my pacemaker four times. They couldn't do it. And they didn't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I was there for 5 hours. For the last 2.5 I was there, there was a young man who was maybe 25 feet away from me on his gurney in his room. I felt like Les Nessman. You know, they got those, they put the tape down, stay behind the yellow line, okay? I know people don't know what I'm talking about. It's WKRP in Cincinnati. And I'm not going to go through all that, but I felt like Les Nessman, for those of you who know who he was. It's a character. And he's playing his music videos, but he's not wearing a headset. He wants everybody to hear his music videos, okay? And then in between, he's making, it's 2:30 in the morning. He is making video calls, not with a headset where I had, you know, he just had to speak in the headset. We have to hear the entire conversation. Now, I have to admit it was in a foreign language, so I didn't understand what they were saying, okay? But this is what, I mean, literally, and people bumping into things and carts with noises going through, I mean, closing your eyes to even take a little nap is ridiculous, okay? What I did learn, though, what I have learned, is that medicine, and this is for my own doctor, medicine has become an assembly line production. Doctors bring in, a doctor will see as many as 50 patients a day, 50. And it's like an assembly line. You go to this room to have your blood pressure taken. You go to this room to have your EKG done. You go to this room to have your pacemaker read. You go to this room to talk to the nursing assistant or the physician nursing, whatever, you know, mini doctor. Okay, and you go to all these different rooms, and then they take you into a room, and the doctor comes in. And he gives you about 4 minutes and says, here's the pills for today. Have a nice day. No causation, no thought process of why you're not feeling well. Here's a pill that'll make you feel better. We don't care why. It's like the doctor's the guy that puts the headlights on the F-150 on the assembly line. That's American medicine, people. And the AMA says we don't need any more medical schools. We have enough doctors. They don't want any more doctors because that's less money for the doctors they already got. And God forbid you should have to call a doctor's office if the doctor's part of a health program. You talk to an operator who sends you to a message person who takes down what you want to say and writes a message by email to the doctor's office who that's read by some nursing assistant or whatever, and maybe the doctor sees the note and responds to it after a couple of 3 days. That's American medicine today. The care has gone down, but the dollars are going up. Now, that has nothing to do with the Constitution. Absolutely nothing to do with the Constitution, except for I got it off my chest, and I'm done. Thank you very much. Okay, your turn.
Oh, boy. That's.
I feel like applauding.
Yeah. Right. Maybe we should end the show right now.
and I'll take it. I'll take it. Okay, I'll take a little applause. Okay, I could use a hand
right
here and there. Okay?
Yeah. Yeah, it is funny. I was thinking as you were talking, you know, I mean, I'm sure, you know, many, many Americans have had this experience, right? You go in and you're right. They don't look for what caused the problem. Just here's a pill to fix the problem.
then the pill that you take to fix that problem causes another problem. So you got to go back. But
right.
then you got to get the pill to fix that problem for the first. Then that pill causes another problem. So you got to be on a third pill for that problem. And it just keeps snowballing, right? It's like it's a pharmaceutical-driven system, it seems like, right? There's nothing.
It's called job security.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm. Right. It's, I feel embarrassed, you know, going to the pharmacy. You know, I walk in there, I say just give me half the pharmacy and I'll be on my way, right? I mean, I clean the place out. anyway,
Brendan,
yeah. So
the joke.
Yeah. No, that's actually true. But anyway, yeah, I mean, it relates. Everything we talk about relates. You know, we usually call this the Constitution today, but we meander into other areas because there's a lot that affects the health of a constitution, in your case, literally, right, the health of a constitutional republic. And, you know, the systems, the systems that, you know, that surround us all, you know, sometimes are relevant. And to that end, you know, what I really think this morning is only tangentially related to the Constitution, but it has an impact on the health of our republic. And what I really think this morning is that Elon Musk needs to get lost.
Mm.
He has confused wealth, great wealth, with wisdom. And the two are not the same. You can accumulate a lot of money without having a clue, right, about any. Now, he has a clue about rocket engines. I'll give him that. You know, he's a workaholic. He has a clue about engineering and mechanics. And you know, he's good. But then that's what you ought to stick to. The fact that, and by the way, half of his ideas are really goofy too. He's got some real doozies. But you know, give him credit. He owns, you know, Tesla and SpaceX. All right, stick to that. Because he's obviously way out of his depth when it comes to social media and Twitter. I have a hard time discerning his politics, but he you know, he's of a mind to say, he's been tweeting, of course, that, you know, when he takes over Twitter, the extreme left and the extreme right are both going to be unhappy. And apparently he tweeted yesterday or today that Twitter has a, you know, an obvious left-wing bias. I just can't help but talk about this for a minute. First of all, and Jeff, I think almost every week we talk about false equivalence and whataboutism.
Yeah, we
I
do.
Struggle. Yeah, I really struggle. You know, if you ask me to identify far right, it'll take me five seconds, and I've got a picture in my head. I know what it looks. I know what that looks like. It's authoritarian. It's totalitarian. It's violent. It's the ideologies are easy to identify. A lot of antis, right? Anti-choice, anti-gay, anti-immigrant, right? This all, you can rattle off, you know, extreme right. I know exactly what you're talking about in America. And they say, you equate that to something called the extreme left that Elon Musk talks about. And I just want to ask, what are you talking about? What does that mean, the extreme left in the United States? Does that mean people like Jeff Swartz who think that maybe that we should improve our healthcare system? Is that an extreme left position? People who are concerned about climate change? Is that what you mean by? I'm really struggling to know what is meant by extreme left. That people should have access to college educations. Is that what you mean by extreme left? Maybe what you mean by extreme left is people who believe in, oh, this is a bad term now, right? Social justice. Ooh, can't have that. There's a guy named, I think his name is James O'Brien, out in the UK, that hosts a radio show out there. I saw a segment of his recently where he talks about these things that conservatives turn into dirty words, right? Social justice is now something that's you know, that's something bad. Is that what you mean by extreme left? I don't know what these people are talking about, extreme right and extreme left. Now, I'll grant that there are liberals who can be reckless with their words and their deeds. They can do dangerous things. They can come up with goofy ideas and all of that. So we can, you know, we can distract ourselves with the outliers, the people who say and do reckless things on the left, with an entire movement on the right that's based on lies and dangerous ideologies. After January 6th, all we heard was, oh, both sides do it. Right, on the Trump side, you got the people who did January 6th. But what about Black Lives Matter? Right, boy, you know, some storefronts were damaged, right, during BLM protests. And what Elon Musk apparently has bought into is that those are the same thing, right? And we're entitled to treat them the same way, and hear all sides, you know, regarding all issues, even if that involves nothing but lies and misinformation. And I want to make this one final point. You talk about extreme left and extreme right. You know, if you would condemn January 6th, why won't you condemn people who participated in Black Lives Matter protests where storefronts were damaged and property was damaged or stolen? Why won't you condemn that? Okay, let me answer that question. Because one of these things is something that I think is bad behavior that results in, you know, bad outcomes. The other is something that threatens to end the American experiment in democracy. Okay. Any questions?
No.
About which one is worse? Which one is not like the other?
Well, I have to say this, though. There was condemnation from so-called liberals over the violence that took place by Black Lives Matter, especially after a couple of unfortunate incidents involving police officers. Okay. It was there.
Right.
We can't say it wasn't there. What the right is saying is you didn't condemn it enough. You didn't make them into real bad guys. You didn't pursue them with the Department of Justice.
And you didn't equate first them of all, right, to the January 6th riot.
Yeah. There was no conflating the two. Okay. Mm-hmm. One was civil disobedience that caused damage to individuals, which are covered under state law.
Mm-hmm.
The other is the Department of Justice investigating what amounts to be an insurrection and an attempt to overthrow the United States government. Do not think those two things are covered, one, under the same jurisdiction, or number two, that they're anywhere near the other.
Mm-hmm.
In the Black Lives Matter, in those protests, the protesters didn't kill anybody. Yet in an insurrection, people were killed. The police were battled to a certain extent, but there wasn't an attempt to go and murder the Vice President of the United States or the Speaker of the House or the President Pro Tem of the Senate or to interfere with an election, which affects every single person in this country. Not the same thing. Don't even come close. And don't make it racial because it's not racial. It's not part of your loss of white privilege that the white people are being set upon. That's not so. So don't even go there with that one. You live in a world that doesn't exist if you're on the far right. Now, I will give the far right credit. The Oath Keepers are rolling over on Donald. They're talking about how they had direct contact with him. They're telling the committee and they're telling the federal government everything they know. Told you they'd fold, didn't I?
Mm-hmm.
I told you they'd fold like a cheap suit. So the far right is what it is. But the far right really doesn't have anything to stand up for. That's the problem. They're not standing up for something. They're for destroying something. And there is a difference. Maybe I see it wrong. I don't know.
No.
Third base.
No, that's right. That's right. And then again, I just don't. When people talk about the extreme right and extreme left as though there's two equivalent forces in this country, I have no idea what they're talking about. That's the danger of the Elon Musks of the world.
Yes. Yeah.
He doesn't think. He doesn't perceive things the way they are. And he's going to be in charge.
Because when you have his kind of
platform.
Money, when you have his kind of money, it doesn't matter what you think.
Right.
Because you're going to live your life the way you want to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't care. I got all this money. I don't like what's going on. I'll just buy an island. I'll hire my own
army. If I don't
army.
Like Twitter, I'll buy it.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
So, right. You know, that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Must be nice.
All right. I would believe it probably would be, yes. I can look at it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about something else. Let's talk a little Donald. You want to talk a little Donald?
Yeah, I think that's appropriate.
You know, you remember him, the other guy, you know?
Yeah.
The other guy? Okay, let's talk
about
him.
The former guy, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the former guy, okay? He's a guy still, but I know what you're talking about. There's a whole lot swirling around. And some of it requires discussion, some of it just enlightenment. We all know that Mark Esper, who some people refer to as Mark Yesper, has written a book. He's the former Secretary of Defense, who got fired in the last 30 days of the Trump. Administration, if you want to call it that, and so that he could be replaced with a guy who would be willing to use the Army to help the January 6th people. And having heard about the book, because he doesn't read, I mean, seriously, no one really believes that Donald Trump read the book, because he doesn't read. So 60 Minutes reached out to Donald Trump for his response to some of the allegations. And he sent a page-long note. And Chris Silas of CNN, you know, put out what he thought were the 9 most outlandish lines from this response. And his response to the request from Nora O'Donnell for an interview was, see you soon. Because no matter how Trump talks about the media, he loves them. He lives for the media. Okay? Whether it's newspapers, television, they're all dishonest, but I love you. I say you're dishonest and you're the enemy of the people because it's strictly business, but I really do love you. okay? You know, pack for a trip, take the cannolis, leave the gun, you know? The Godfather's life. One of the things that Esper said was that at a cabinet meeting in June of 20, that he had proposed that the Army and the National Guard should shoot the Black Lives Matter protesters, and they should shoot them in the legs. Trump's response was, I never said that. That's an utter and complete lie, and I can provide the names of 10 witnesses who can prove that I never said that. Really? I can provide 10 people who think that I should be playing center field for the New York Yankees. That doesn't mean they're telling the truth because they've never seen me play baseball. Okay? So, how do you check who these 10 people are that he can't name? He said that Esper was weak and totally ineffective, and that he, meaning Donald Trump, had to run the military. That's why he called them my generals and my military. Not our generals, not the country's generals or the country's military, his generals and his military. I know a guy, well, I didn't know him, he died in 1945, but I know of a guy who always felt that the Army was his. Okay? You know, they didn't talk about it belonging to the country. They were loyal to him. But we won't use his name because we're not allowed to do that. Apparently, he says that Esper was a yes man. That's why they called him Yesper. And Trump was trying to argue two seemingly contradictory things about Esper, that he was ineffective, but that he would do anything Trump wanted. How could both of those be right? Anybody explain that to me? How could he be ineffective at doing his job, but he did everything that Donald told him to do? Or is that saying Donald is ineffective and an idiot? That's the only way that can be true, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
He was ineffective at being Secretary of State because he was doing what Donald told him to do instead of what his job was. That's the only way that can be true, by the way. Let's see. Okay. 60 Minutes to propose a proper the election fraud. When he wanted to talk about that, he says there's zero evidence that he ever asked for 10,000 troops in Washington ahead of January 6, 2021. Of course he did. He wanted his army to help overthrow the government. Without any question. Oh, by the way, he was asked about the Mexican missiles, and he had no comment on that. You all know what I'm talking about, the Mexican missiles.
Mm-hmm.
He was going to fire missiles into Mexico to get rid of the drug labs and the drug lords without telling Mexico mm-hmm. they were doing it, and said, they're just going to get blown up. Nobody will know it's us. Okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, wait a minute. Okay? You walk up to a little kid and say, did you steal a cookie? And he says, I don't have a cookie. And he's got crumbs all over his mouth. Okay? I mean, seriously, they're not going to know it's us shooting missiles into Mexico. Seriously?
God.
Okay, I mean, you know, why don't you just pour chlorine bleach down your throat? It'll get rid of COVID.
Guy's a genius.
Yeah. He really is. I mean, but nobody
knows.
Don't forget,
you can solve hurricanes by dropping a nuke on it, right? That was another one of his theories.
Yeah.
Why don't you just
nuke the hurricane? Or you can make it go
hurricane.
Where you want it to go with a Sharpie.
Right.
Okay. That hurricane didn't go there. It went over there. See, my Sharpie says so. Okay. Okay. I had to get that one out. That was just a little Donald stuff that we just had to talk about. I think we agreed we need to talk about the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
We really do.
Yeah.
And
but before that, I do want to.
But I digress. But I digress.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, God. It's, you made two points that got me to thinking. One is that he doesn't read.
You had to think about that? Really?
No. I just had to think about an angle, a different angle on it, which is.
Oh, okay. All right.
It's interesting.
That. Okay.
This seems like, and I'm wondering if you've noticed this too, seems like a recurring theme when we have Republican presidents. You know, they don't read. In particular, the last two.
Yeah, Bush didn't read.
Famous stories coming out of the White House. If you had more than one page to show him, doesn't matter how complex the issue is, if you give him more than a one-page document to read, he won't read it. And even if you do give him a one-page document, half of it better be pictures. And then
Mickey
then
Mouse
Donald Trump, same thing. Yeah, right.
Yeah, Mickey Mouse representations.
We're electing these people president of the United States, and they won't read. Maybe you need to think about that if you're in a political party that keeps nominating people like Dan Quayle, Sarah Palin,
mm-hmm.
Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
George W. Bush. Come on. Get serious. The other thing you said and you're right, it's like this taboo thing. You're not allowed to draw comparisons between what's going on in the United States now and what happened in Germany. We all know when.
What's going on in Florida? Forget the United States. What's going on in Florida?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And anybody, you know, I don't know who would doubt that Donald Trump said that we should shoot protesters in the legs. I mean, who would doubt that, right? I mean, that's obviously something he would say if you were awake for 4 years watching this guy. And that brings me to the point of comparison. You know, as Ari Melber a while back, the MSNBC host, was talking about J.D. Vance. And J.D. Vance is the guy who Donald Trump endorsed, in Ohio, even though J.D. Vance once was really a never-Trumper, right?
Excuse me.
And J.D. Vance had once said, quote, right, that Donald Trump could be America's Hitler. And Ari Melber said that's an outrageous comparison. And I just wanted to throw something at the television, okay, because, look, nobody is saying that Donald Trump caused the same types of, you know, grotesque results. But the question isn't whether he already has. The question is whether he would if he could. The point of knowing history is not to stop the last Hitler. We can't anymore. It's too late. The point of knowing history is to stop the next one before it's too late. So people need to stop saying we can't make appropriate historical comparisons when that's the point of knowing history. Is to stop it from happening again, not to equate what has happened to what happened then, but to stop it from happening again.
Yeah.
That's enough of my rant. Sorry.
It is. No. It's okay. It's exactly what it's about. It really is an issue that we already have the next Hitler. And we have two of them, actually. We got one that governs the state of Florida and one that, at least for 4 years, played at governing the United States. And it really is a question of stopping them. It doesn't mean they aren't like them, and it doesn't mean they're not trying to follow that playbook. Because there really is no issue that that's what's happening in the state of Florida. Things that couldn't get done on the federal system are being done in the state of Florida. And I've said this before, I love, and I always give this disclaimer. Charlie Crist is a friend of mine. I've known him for 27 years. And I think that he is to me, a really great public servant who has served in a number of capacities, has recognized when he's wrong, who's made choices to get away from people that he knows are bad. And I think that's wonderful. The problem is Charlie is a very quiet, easygoing kind of guy who has rarely, if ever, shown any form of temper, who doesn't allow himself to show the anger he claims to feel. Mm. And if you're going to beat Ron DeSantis, Charlie, you better learn to raise your voice. You better learn to show anger, not talk anger, show anger. It just has to be done. And you have to call him out for what he is. And you have to let people know what he is. And you have to force them to make that choice. Because remember, this guy only won his governorship by 0.2%. So the state hasn't changed that much. Maybe the districts are misaligned, but it doesn't change the number of people that can vote. So... yeah, we have a problem. And people that can't be afraid to make the reference to Nazis, because Nazism is just fascism. Nazism was anti-Semitic fascism. It doesn't mean that you can't be a Nazi unless you hate Jews. You can be a Nazi and hate Mexicans.
Mm-hmm.
You can be a Nazi and hate black people. It is the form of government and in the totalitarian way that it is asserted against the people, and the fact that it becomes a way of life. We teach people how to live their lives exactly as they are supposed to live their lives. That's Nazism. That's fascism. And it doesn't, just because DeSantis isn't picking on Jews, he doesn't like little black mice. He doesn't like Mickey Mouse. That's his new boogeyman, Mickey Mouse. Mm-hmm. Everything he wants to do has a boogeyman attached to it. Somebody else for you to be afraid of. People who would hate each other otherwise learn the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I love Ron DeSantis because he hates Mickey Mouse. I love Ron DeSantis because he's a racist. I love Ron DeSantis because he's going to keep all that critical race theory stuff away from my kid. I love Ron DeSantis because he hates gay people. So I hate gay people. I don't mind black people, but I hate gay people, so I'm going to vote for Ron DeSantis, and I'll hold my nose about the rest of it. Stop holding your nose, people. You know, make a choice. Democracy or totalitarianism, there is no in-between, and there is no controlling people who want to become dictators. You cannot control them. You cannot give them power. They will use it against you, and you lose. Germany, 1933, will control Hitler. Took them a year to take over the entire country. Enough. Stop living in your dream worlds. My life will never change. Doesn't matter what the government does. Bull hockey. So there. Okay.
Yeah,
get
elections,
that out of our
elections don't matter. Ask the teenage girl who has to have her father's child whether elections matter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the woman, the girl that in later years has to look at the child she bore and said, I'm not your mother, I'm your sister.
Mm-hmm.
That's, we grew up together. Don't you remember?
Yeah.
You know, sooner or later, I'm my own grandpa is really going to happen. That's crazy. Which brings us to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, good segue.
Talk about crazy? Yeah, we got crazy. On the less than lighter side of all of this, I mean, I've got Clarence in my crosshairs, but right now I've got Sam Alito. He's more than in my crosshairs. He's standing right in front of me. There's something very disturbing about this proposed majority opinion. There's nine references by Alito to one of the great misogynists of all time as authority for what he's doing. The guy's name is Sir Matthew Hale. And you say, what the hell is Sir Matthew Hale? And now you're really going to laugh, because he was the Chief Justice of England in 1671.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know.
The good old days.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. Well, what are we talking about here? 600 years ago, 550 years ago? But yet, this is Alito's guidestone. And I also want you to remember in 1671 that there was battles going on within England between papists, the Catholic Church, people who wanted to stay Catholic, and people who wanted to be Protestant. And even to this day, there are still Catholics in England. People think there are, but there are. And Hale was this Chief Justice who, for one thing, felt in his view that and came up with the idea that a husband cannot rape his wife, that she has no right to say no, because that's her duty. Alito's draft cites Hale with a quote that says he described abortion of a quick child who died in the womb as a great crime and a great misprison. He wrote that there is an unbroken tradition of prohibiting abortion on pain of criminal punishment up until Roe. Well, I'm sorry, that was 1973, not 1671. And the United States is not a theocracy. I know that's a real shock to you, Justice Alito and Justice Thomas and Sister Mary, or Amy, I mean. But we're not a theocracy. And if you don't believe me, just read the Treaty of, the Treaty of Morocco?
The Treaty of Tripoli.
That ended Tripoli, written by John Adams. And now you're going to tell me John Adams didn't know what he was talking about. John Adams, I don't know, helped write the Declaration of Independence. He had nothing to do with the Constitution, by the way. He was in France during that time. Hale was one of the great misogynists of all time. To Hale, English gentlewomen were the ruin of families. Young women were a particular source of despair to him. They learned to be bold, he complained, and they talk loud. Wow, would he not be able to function in today's world?
Mm-hmm.
Hale wrote a book called Unbelievable. The book was an extension of a story that he wrote called An Unbelievable Story of Rape. Hale believed that for women, it was easy to accuse a man of rape. He believed that for men, such accusations were hard to defend, even if innocent. He advised that jurors be warned explicitly and at length about the threat of the false accuser. He came up with a quick list of factors to weigh jurors, he wrote, should consider. Is the woman claiming rape of good fame or evil fame? Did she cry out? Did she try to flee? Did she make a media complaint afterwards? Does she stand supported by others? And for many years, even in this country, failure to resist violently a rape was a cause for the charge to be dismissed. An element of the offense was that a woman had to resist, physically resist. But that wasn't Hale's only legacy. In 1622, he presided at the trial of two women accused of witchcraft. He instructed the jury that witches are real, saying Scripture affirmed as much. Now, I tell you that story because Alito tells you that a fetus is a living person as of conception and should be punishable. Because the Bible says so. He doesn't say it, but because his Bible says so. By the way, the two women were convicted, and Hale sentenced them both to hang. Hale is known for his legal treatises, but just as revealing as the letter he wrote to his granddaughters. He told his granddaughter, one of his granddaughters, needed to govern the greatness of her spirit, lest she become proud, imperious, and revengeful. The other granddaughter could make a good housewife, Hale wrote, provided she kept in some awe, especially in relation to lying and deceiving. As for her granddaughter, Anne, he perceived a soft nature, therefore forbade balls, ballads, or melancholic books. The letter that he wrote to these three young ladies was 182 pages long. If you look at his portrait, you can see that this is a man who literally had no sense of humor. And apparently, it was an appropriate portrait because he never, ever smiled. this man that I've described to you is Sam Alito's hero. This is his hero. This is how he patterns being a judge. Be a misogynist. Teach the scriptures. Sam, you missed your calling. It's time to leave the bench, go into the seminary, and become the priest you've always wanted to be. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll get assigned to Rome and you can really work for the Pope. But you are not his representative in the United States government. This is 2022, not 1671. Life has changed, much to your great chagrin. This is the guy that's writing an opinion. Shame on the people who follow him. Sister Amy, I'm not surprised. Clarence Thomas, I'm not surprised. Gorsuch, I'm surprised, despite his personal views. He's a bad guy. We've just found out how bad he really is. This is a guy you want to be? Why don't you put on your suit of armor and call for Sancho and Dulcinea and go tilt at some windmills? Don Quixote. You got anything to follow up on that one with?
It's funny, you know, when you hear commentators talking about how the court wants to drag us back, and I keep hearing people say, you know, they want to drag us back to the 1970, or they want to drag us back into the 1950s. You know, happy days are here again. And every time I hear that, I think you are way understating where they want to bring us back to. People should really be clear on what, this is called a judicial philosophy or an interpretive methodology, but, you know, what it really is, of course, is an ideology dressed up, right, as a fancy interpretive methodology. And what I'm talking about is something lawyers and judges call originalism. I think it's fair to say that Scalia is the one who really popularized this. And it's the undergirding of the Federalist Society and other outfits like that. And the theory goes like this. The Constitution is not a living, breathing document. It does not evolve with the times. It does not accommodate change. So certainly not cultural or social change. And so when you look at, we all have to agree the word abortion is not in the Constitution. There's a lot of words that are not in the Constitution. It's a relatively short document written in very general terms, often vague terms. So it doesn't say abortion, but it does say liberty more than once. And so the question before judges is always, you know, in cases like this, you know, okay, the Constitution doesn't guarantee abortion, but it guarantees liberty. What does that mean? What does that include? The question is, if the state can govern this decision, if the state can make this decision for a woman, then does the woman really enjoy liberty, which we can all agree is guaranteed by the Constitution? Is this woman really living in a free country if the state has jurisdiction over this choice? That's the question. Now, to an originalist, this is a very easy question to resolve because the theory goes like this. The Constitution means what any average idiot would have thought it meant when it was ratified. They don't even want to go near what the people who wrote it meant, because the people who wrote the Constitution were rather audacious. And modern conservatives want nothing to do with that kind of thinking. Right? The people who wrote the Constitution were radical liberals, right, of their time. So we don't want to get inside their heads about this. Originalism, they've been very clear about this now. Originalism means not what the founders or the drafters of the Constitution meant by the words. It's what any person off the street would have thought the word meant at the time. So they're dumbing it down as much as possible, keeping it as superficial as possible. Would the average person reading the 14th Amendment, which was adopted in 1868, so we're not talking 1950s here, folks, 1868, would the normal person reading the 14th Amendment, which guarantees liberty, right, and the 14th Amendment was adopted in 1868, would the average person think that that included abortion in 1868? You go pull the law books off the shelves from 1868, you find that in every state at the time, abortion was illegal, and there you go, you've answered the question. Right? The question to an originalist is not whether this is inherently part of a free society in 2022. The question to an originalist is whether this was considered something people were allowed to do without governmental interference in 1868. And now, Jeff, what you're describing is originalism on steroids. This guy is going back to the 1600s and the 13th century.
And going back to Old English common law, let me ask this question: Did the 14th Amendment in any way, shape, or form contemplate the exclusionary rule? Did the 14th Amendment in 1868 contemplate Miranda, or Gideon versus Wainwright, or Katz, or Terry? In any way, shape, or form, did the 14th Amendment contemplate right to counsel? People talk about, okay, they're going to start interfering with contraceptive rights, which apparently Mississippi is already talking about, or who you can marry. Okay, because the 14th Amendment gives you the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those things were not even considered when the 14th Amendment was passed and ratified. So when they start talking about those other things, start talking about your personal liberties, people. A police officer, for any reason, can just pull you over and pat you down because Terry versus Ohio is based on the 14th Amendment and it's not explicitly in the 14th Amendment. And the Fourth Amendment only applies because this is all that they thought it should apply to. It applies to the federal government. It doesn't apply to the states. And it doesn't apply to the states because the 14th Amendment can't make it do that. Where does the line get drawn till we end up being Rob Petrie tripping over his ottoman on his way in the door? When do we become Ozzy and Harriet? And by the way, what did Ozzy ever do for a living? The man never went to work. Just walked around the house in a cardigan and a tie all day. Those are the good old days. I don't know. Are we going to start telling people they got to sleep in twin beds now, too? Rob and Laura Petrie slept in twin beds. The first people on television who ever slept in the same bed was Suzanne Pleshette and Bob Newhart. Before that, you never saw anybody in a king-size bed. How far is this going to go? How far back are we going to go? when people say you're talking absurdities, they'll never overrule Terry versus Ohio. Oh, yeah? Congress in 1988 tried to overturn Miranda. And but for a Supreme Court finding that law to be unconstitutional, Miranda could have been overruled by Congress. I hate to say it. It's so hard to say. Thank goodness for William Rehnquist, but that's so hard. I'm going to have to take a Clorox shower when I get done with this show. Thank goodness for William Rehnquist. You don't realize how backwards these people are.
I have a question. Based on how went through the process and got designated onto the Supreme Court, when this is part of their history. Well, at that time, we didn't know what their history was.
They lied.
How come we don't have a better way of vetting?
They lied. They lied, Hezzy. I believe Anita Hill.
Yeah, me too.
I believe, what was her name, Professor, what was her last name, the one with Kavanaugh?
Mm-hmm.
I'll think of it in a minute. I believe her. Kavanaugh lied about that. Kavanaugh lied about super precedent, not overturning Roe v. Wade, lied to Susan Collins' face, lied to the American people, lied to the Senate. Sam Alito is the leader of the liars. Listen to his testimony and say, how did you get, you were writing this opinion the day you took office. Seriously, we're supposed to believe you had an epiphany? That you got more religious all of a sudden? And even more so, Gorsuch, who writes a book about stare decisis and then does exactly what the book says you don't do? I expect it from Clarence Thomas. Because Clarence Thomas doesn't have a brain. He doesn't have a thought for himself. He does what's good for his wife's business. This is what we have on the Supreme Court right now. This is what we have. They lie to say whatever they have to say so that they can get a vote from the other party so they can get the votes they need to get past cloture. Because they need 60. At least back then they did. These people don't belong there. If you want to know why people don't have faith in the Supreme Court, look at the people that are sitting there. Don't look at the people themselves, which is what Thomas thinks the problem is. Young people have no respect for the court. Well, they look at you and they say, how am I supposed to trust you? Forget the court. I'm looking you in the eye, Clarence Thomas. I'm saying, I don't trust you. He doesn't take it that he's not trusted. They have no respect for the law. Bull. They got more respect for the law than you do. They lie, Izzy. That's how they get there. They lie. Are you shocked?
Yes.
You shouldn't be. You shouldn't be. Some of us have known it for years.
I'm catching up.
Yeah. Time to start reading. Time to start watching TV.
Absolutely.
Am I wrong, Brendan?
No. They were not. I'll soften it. They were less than truthful in their testimony. before the
I
Senate.
Put intent on it. I put intent on what they said. Okay, you don't want to put intent. I put intent on what they said. Okay, Amy Coney Barrett, sister Amy. Okay. At least danced around the question. And she'd written enough to say that she was there with an agenda to overturn Roe v. Wade. There should have been no doubts about it. She'd published enough to let everybody know exactly where she was. And she said that Roe is not a super precedent. She said that.
Mm-hmm.
How much more of a hint do you have to have? At least she was honest. We all knew. She came on a mission. Question is, who's next? Gay marriage? Interracial marriage? The Pope says no. The only contraception you can use is the rhythm method. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
Is she going to say anti-contraception laws are legal because the Bible says so? Or no, the Bible doesn't say that. The Pope said that in an encyclical. God knows how many decades ago. I don't know where we go other than the confession. Brendan, you're so quiet.
Well, I'm not going to interrupt this.
You can interrupt anytime you want to. You know that.
No. I do see we are we run over time.
There you go. Wow!
So
did you take cap lessons
time
when
is
you were a kid?
Interruption. Time is the interruption.
Oh, I can hear the clicking of your shoes. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Oh God.
Oh. Okay. Well, I by the way, my request for an audience with the Pope has been denied.
Yeah, I bet it has.
Okay, I don't think that's ever going to happen. Even if I say I'll speak Spanish to him and he'll understand, okay? I don't think they're going to let me in. Okay.
Yeah.
How about Latin? I'll learn Latin just so we can talk in Latin.
There you go.
So okay. All right. So you want? Yeah, we have a faculty meeting.
Yep, we do.
Are you going to do it online? Or are you going to show up?
No, I'm online.
Yeah, good. Okay, then I won't feel alone. Okay.
Yeah, no.
I'm going to stay right here where I'm at. I'm not going anywhere.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. Hezzy?
That makes two of us.
I hope you have something to kill the last hour with.
Yep.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's just that
okay.
I always plan for you guys going over, just in case.
Yeah,
but I'm prepared for a full hour.
All right.
All the best to both of you. It's been enlightening.
You too, Hezzy. Have a good
TV
week.
From now on.
Brendan, I'll see you at noon. Okay?
All right, sounds good.
Take care.
Yep, bye-bye, everybody.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care, guys. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it, folks. The Constitution today, and with Professor Jeffrey Swartz, and former judge and constitutional, as well as criminal lawyer, and Brendan Beery, also constitutional lawyer, both at WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa, Florida campus. Doesn't get better than that. All right, well, let's move on to the next segment. And what we're going to do is we're going to be moving on to what's happening on the international stage. Bear with me a moment. And a lot's happened, that's for sure. One thing, bear with me a second. Let me just find where this is. Bear with me a second. Yeah. First thing I want to start off with an opinion that was presented by Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany, who finds clear words on Ukraine. So in his speech to the nation marking the end of World War II, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz explained why Germany needs to support Ukraine. He has found the right words to get his message across, and this is what we learned. On May 8, 1945, was the day that Germany unconditionally surrendered, bringing the Second World War to an end, at least in Europe. Now war has once again returned to the continent. After a few months of what seemed like dithering, Chancellor Scholz seems to have embraced the reality of this war. There is no choice, he said. Germany must do everything in its power to support Ukraine, and that includes supplying heavy weapons. Quote, we will continue to do so, end quote, vowed Scholz in his TV address on Sunday evening. He made clear that German weapons deliveries will continue beyond the Gepard, those are the tanks, and howitzers that Germany has already promised to send to Ukraine. Well, from May 8th comes a commitment. Never again, quote unquote, is the lesson Germany has drawn from World War II, a war in which Nazi Germany brought endless suffering to the people of Ukraine. In view of Russia's current war of aggression, Scholz has now said that this, quote, never again, end quote, is the basis for Germany's special responsibility and obligation towards Ukraine. Furthermore, defending law and freedom alongside those who have been attacked is the legacy of May 8th, said Scholz. The chancellor has been on Ukraine's side from the very beginning. Just 3 days after the Russian invasion, Scholz proclaimed a Zeitenwende, a paradigm shift in German politics, in a speech to the Bundestag, that's the government, that's like the Congress, and told the nation that from now on many things would be different. But the strong words were not immediately followed by strong action. Germany initially found it very difficult to decide how to provide Ukraine with adequate military support. The German defense minister initially spoke of the delivery of 5,000 steel helmets to Ukraine as a great feat, and that was simply embarrassing. Putting all the blame on Olaf Scholz is not quite fair. The chancellor does not act alone. He needs the approval of his coalition partners and, of course, the support of his own party. And this he did not get to the fullest degree. There is widespread and deeply rooted pacifism in the center-left Social Democrats Party, the SPD, and for many party members, quote, creating peace without weapons, end quote, is not just a slogan, but a fundamental belief. Initially, there was strong resistance within the party to arms deliveries to a war zone. And this resistance is also widespread in German society. Not everyone in this country likes the idea of Germany supplying tanks. But the longer the war in Ukraine has gone on, the more obvious it has become that the Russian army is rampaging, murdering, raping, and torturing. It has become clear that this war cannot be ended through dialogue, and no one can ignore this now. Well, the policy of détente has failed, but it was not only pacifism that stood in the SPD's way. For decades, the SPD believed in dialogue with the Soviet Union and later with Russia. Its chancellor and Nobel Peace Prize laureate, Willy Brandt, invented the policy of détente with its slogan, quote, change through rapprochement, which later the government under Chancellor Angela Merkel from the center-right Christian Democrats, the CDU, transformed into, quote, change through trade, end quote. For far too long, the belief was upheld that Russia only had to be integrated economically in order to preserve the peace. For too long, the SPD was focused on Russia and ignored the warnings of the other Eastern Europeans. Now it has fallen flat on its face with this strategy. Acknowledging the failure and drawing consequences from it was a process that has taken Olaf Scholz and his party sometime. The chancellor has made the transition, as the speech shows. He took a stance and explained his position, and he hit the right note. That's good. Previously, his decision-making process was perceived internationally as dithering and hesitant, and that has hurt Germany. Now the German citizens have been told that the war will probably last for a long time, and it will have consequences for all people here in Germany, too. Olaf Scholz has promised that he will do everything in his power to prevent damage to the country. He also wants to refrain from doing anything that could be seen as entering the war, and he wants to proceed jointly with Germany's allies. After the speech, there should be no more ambiguities, because the chancellor cannot go back on the words he has now found. And that's the best prerequisite for him to travel to Kyiv now. And just so you know, this was originally written in Germany, in German rather. Very, very compelling, to say the least. And let's look at what's going on in Moldova. Moldova's struggle with a frozen conflict, quote unquote, and Russian uncertainty. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres is visiting Moldova, the country that has taken in the most Ukrainian refugees relative to its own size. And the small nation is one of Europe's poorest and faces many, many challenges. The Republic of Moldova in Eastern Europe is a small country, has a population of fewer than 3 million people, but that number fluctuates because of mass migration. It is estimated that at least one-third of Moldovans are currently working abroad, which makes pinning down the exact number difficult. And there are figures we do know. Moldova has taken in more than 450,000 refugees from its neighbor Ukraine since Russia invaded the country in late February, starting a war that still rages today. When compared to Moldova's own population, that's the largest number of Ukrainian refugees any country has taken in. Now, the small nation's outsized willingness to receive Ukrainian refugees will be a focus of United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres while he visits Moldova. That was yesterday and today. And the United Nations news website states that Guterres is traveling to Moldova, quote, to support the refugees and personally thank the Moldovans and all who assist them, end quote. Moldova gained independence in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The official language of Moldova is Romanian. The small country shares a border marked by the Prut River, P-R-U-T River, with Romania to the west. And until 1940, most of what is Moldova today was part of Romania. Then Soviet forces invaded areas east of the Prut River and established the Moldovan Soviet Socialist Republic. The majority of the population in today's Moldova are ethnically Romanian. Everyone who is of Romanian origin has a right to a Romanian passport, which many Moldovans made use of. Having this passport makes them citizens of the European Union, as Romania joined the bloc in 2007. Since the country is so poor, many Moldovans leave to work abroad in the European Union and send money home to their families. At the eastern edge of the country, where Moldova borders Ukraine, lies the separatist region of Transnistria. It seceded from Moldova after a brief military conflict in 1992. The separatists were supported by troops from Moscow. Even today, Russia has around 1,500 troops stationed in the region and regularly conducts military exercises there. Now, roughly 60% of the population in Transnistria is Russian-speaking, 60%. The separatists dubbed the region Pridnestrovian Moldovan Republic, PMR, but not even Russia considers it a sovereign state. The region's other two official languages are Romanian and Ukrainian. Together with Russian, they represent the three major ethnic groups living in Transnistria. Now, the region's population has declined over the years amid the so-called frozen conflict, quote-unquote, and is estimated to number around 460,000 people. Russian soldiers stationed in the separatist region are a major headache for the Moldovan government, especially since Russian military authorities have stated that control of southern Ukraine would give Russia a gateway to Transnistria, where there are, quote, facts of oppression of the Russian-speaking population, end quote, as a Russian military commander puts it. In 1994, 3 years after it gained independence, Moldova explicitly included its neutrality in the constitution. Like Switzerland, the country stated it would not take sides in international conflicts. There's speculation that the reason behind the move was to get Russian troops to leave Transnistria, but if that's the case, it didn't work. The neutrality also means that Moldova is not a part of any large alliance, like NATO, for example. small nation hasn't introduced any sanctions against Moscow since the start of the war in Ukraine. The pro-European president, Maya Sandu, who wants her country to join the European Union, has condemned Russia's actions. And that's about as far as any Moldovan politician will go. Moldova is one of the poorest European countries and is heavily dependent on Russian gas supplies. With Russia's recent statements on the perceived oppression, quote-unquote, of Russian speakers and their troops still stationed in Transnistria, many Moldovans fear that a victory of the Russian invading forces in Ukraine could also see the Kremlin march its army into their country. So, and the Russian military has said it wants another way to access Moldova's breakaway Transnistria region. Meanwhile, the United Nations chief is set to travel to Moscow to meet Vladimir Putin. So we're going to have to see where that all goes. So we'll just have to see where that leads. Just frightening stuff that goes on the world stage, no? Now, let's look at something else a little bit further afield from Europe, and let's go over to the Philippines. Marcos Jr. wins the presidential election landslide. With most votes counted, Ferdinand Marcos Jr. had more than 30.8 million votes. A win would return the Marcos dynasty to power, and hundreds gathered to protest the result of the election. Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son and namesake of the ousted dictator, looked set for a comprehensive victory in Monday's presidential election in the Philippines. On Tuesday, hundreds of protesters gathered in the Philippines election body to reject the unofficial election result. They said thousands were unable to vote because of machine malfunctioning. The Commission on Elections, COMELEC, denied calls to extend the voting hours and stressed the number of affected machines was small. Having collected more than 30.8 million votes in the unofficial results with more than 97% of the votes counted, Marcos is on course to replace President Rodrigo Duterte. If we'll be fortunate, I'll expect that your help will not wane. Your trust will not wane because we have a lot of things to do in the times ahead, Marco said in a video that he shared late Monday night. Well, election officials said the vote was relatively peaceful despite pockets of violence in the country's volatile south. The Commission on Elections reported problems with some 2,000 malfunctioning vote counting machines, power outages, missing names on voters' list, and other things, but said the turnout appeared to have been high. Marcos's nearest challenger, Vice President Leni Robredo, had 14.7 million votes. Robredo conceded defeat and said, quote, "The voice of the people is getting clearer and clearer. In the name of the Philippines, which I know you also love so dearly, we should hear this voice because in the end, we only have that voice." And she urged her supporters to press. So Ferdinand Marcos Jr., also known as Bongbong, B-O-N-G, is pitted against the incumbent vice president, Leni Robredo. Marcos Jr. is the son and namesake of a dictator whose two-decade rule ended in a public revolt and his family's retreat into exile. He's leading by over 30 percentage points and has topped every poll this year. This means Robredo will need a late surge or low turnout if she is to win the presidency. It doesn't look likely. Polls open at 6 in the morning local time and are set to stay open longer than usual until 7 p.m. due to the COVID precautions. Eight other candidates, including former boxing star Manny Pacquiao, Manila Mayor Isko Moreno, and former National Police Chief Senator Panfilo Lacson, I don't know what SEN stands for, have lagged far behind in voter preference surveys. So both the main candidates have promised to prioritize economic recovery after the pandemic. Robredo has pledged to increase investments to tackle climate change, level the playing field for business, and promote public-private partnerships. Marcos, who's 64, has not presented many details about his policies, but is expected to carry ahead the same approach as his predecessor Duterte, pursuing a ruthless consolidation of power. Critics say that Marcos is attempting to rewrite the family's controversial history for a youthful electorate, though they believe he is unlikely to replicate his father's authoritarian style of ruling. He made promises in his campaign that played well with the public but aren't particularly practicable. So his campaign has focused on gut issues such as the rising cost of living and lowering electricity prices, but he is providing a vague notion of what he's able to achieve, making it seem more straightforward than it actually is, and people seem to be buying into it. Duterte's daughter, the southern Davao City Mayor Sara Duterte Carpio, has topped surveys as Marcos Jr.'s vice presidential running mate. The two, Marcos and Duterte Carpio, represent the worst brand of traditional politics and governance in our nation's history. We thus call upon the Filipino people to strongly reject Handam and to stand strong against possible and further suppression and violation of the people's rights, human rights group Karapatan told some news agency. And history may repeat itself if they win. There may be a repeal of or repeat of martial law and the drug killings that happened under their parents. Human rights worker Miles Sanchez told Associated Press news agency regarding a Marcos Jr. Duterte Carpio victory. So Robredo, 57, is a former human rights lawyer and staunch liberal, and has pledged to improve education and welfare, fight poverty, and improve market competition if elected. She had narrowly defeated Marcos in the run for vice presidency in 2016. She has criticized Duterte's war on drugs and condemned the senseless killings. A win for Robredo would make her the third woman to lead the Philippines after democracy champion Corazon Aquino in 1986 and Gloria Macapagal Arroyo in 2001. She's running with Francis Pangilinan, a lawyer and senator, and the latest survey put her in second place with 23% support. So we'll see. We'll see where that goes, but it doesn't look like she's going to be able to make it. Okay, so let's go on to a few other places. Sinn Féin is upset over the game of chicken preventing the formation of executive in Northern Ireland. After a historic election victory, Sinn Féin is ready to pick Northern Ireland's first, but the DUP says it will not form a power-sharing government as long a post-Brexit trade agreement stays in place. Sinn Féin's Vice President Michelle O'Neill warned on Monday she, quote, will not be held to ransom, end quote, by Brexit disputes holding up the formation of a new power-sharing government in Northern Ireland. Sinn Féin, once a political wing of the Irish Republican Party, secured the most seats in the Northern Ireland Assembly during last week's election, becoming the first nationalist party advocating that Northern Ireland join with the Republic of Ireland and leave the United Kingdom to be the largest one in the Stormont Parliament. The DUP, but also the British government, must accept and respect the democratic outcome of this election, O'Neill, who could become the first minister, had said. Power-sharing rules, however, require the participation of the pro-British Democratic Unionist Party, the DUP, which came second to form an executive. The DUP, again, the British Democratic Union Party, a leader, Geoffrey Donaldson, said his party wouldn't nominate ministers to the executive unless the United Kingdom takes decisive action, quote-unquote, to scrap post-Brexit trading arrangements with the European Union, known as the Northern Ireland Protocol. The DUP wants checks on goods entering Northern Ireland from the United Kingdom removed. the GOP's opposed to the protocol that effectively established a border in the Irish Sea. It governs trade between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland and was meant to prevent the return of a hard land border. But unionists say the checks that have created a barrier between Northern Ireland and made a united Ireland, Sinn Féin's aim, more likely. The British government wanted the European Union to agree to major changes, but negotiations faltered so far. The DUP's position in United Kingdom politics during the Brexit process has further complicated their position and damaged their reputation on this issue. At first, they propped up Theresa May's government as an alternative solution was being sought, but were then cast aside by Boris Johnson after 2019's election, when he no longer needed DUP support in the British Parliament. Before inking a deal, he had promised unionists would never be acceptable to his government. And Sinn Féin never takes the seats it wins in the British House of Commons as a point of principle. Now, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has threatened unilateral action to, quote, fix the protocol, but the European Union has warned this could lead to a broader trade war. The European Union also says the protocol is what enables Ireland's internal border to remain open and uncontrolled, which is a matter of core importance to Sinn Féin in particular and to many in Northern Ireland. In a meeting with United Kingdom's Northern Ireland Secretary Brendan Lewis, Donaldson reiterated the GUP's demands that the Northern Ireland Protocol be dropped before any executive could be formed. Quote, we need decisive action to address the difficulties created by the protocol, whether that is driving up the cost of living, whether that is the harm that it is doing to businesses, on our economy, or indeed in undermining political stability, he said. The Sinn Féin says that Northern Ireland cannot be collateral damage in the United Kingdom's European Union talks. Northern Ireland has been without a functioning government since February, when the DUP leader at the time, Paul Given quit as first minister in protest over the protocol. But after she met with Lewis, O'Neill stressed that the situation was untenable. Brinkmanship will not be tolerated where the north of Ireland becomes collateral damage in a game of chicken with the European Commission, she said. Make no mistake, we made our business community here will not be held. We and our business community here will not be held to ransom. Sinn Féin can nominate O'Neill as the first minister, but she cannot take up the office unless the DUP agrees to nominate a deputy first minister. If no executive can be formed, ministers from the previous government would stay in power as a caretaker administration. A new election must be held if there is still no executive after 24 weeks. Such shutdowns of Northern Ireland's executive have been comparatively common historically. The most recent major suspension ended in January of 2020, following almost 3 years of inactivity at Stormont. So we got a major crisis here, and we'll see if it ever gets resolved. It probably needs to be, and we can't be playing this game much longer, because I think politically there's just no stomach for it any longer. Now, let me just look and see what else. Bear with me a second. Okay, let's go back to Germany. On Victory Day, past and present collide in Berlin. The anniversary of the end of World War II in Europe is always a politically charged day in Berlin. And Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which falsely claims to be a fight against fascism, gives new urgency to remembrance. In Berlin, the past is always chasing the present. On some days, like Victory in Europe Day on May 8 and 9, it catches up. The occasion, which marks Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender to Allied forces, always brings out activists to push their particular version of history and understanding of good guys versus bad. This time around, 77 years later, Russia's war in Ukraine has challenged how the deadliest war in human history gets collectively remembered as images of devastation that many thought were the stuff of history books now play out in real life and real time. though German capitulation took place in Berlin on May 8th of 1945, it was already the next day in Moscow. That spreads out events over 2 days. Emotions and complex narratives were on display at the Soviet War Memorial in Berlin's Tiergarten. On Sunday, the Ukrainian embassy oversaw a wreath-laying ceremony as foreign dignitaries and German officials arrived. A few hundred pro-Putin and pro-Ukrainian protesters lined up on the street just outside. Under the watchful eye of dozens of police officers, the two sides traded heated but peaceful barbs, relitigating the past, praising the Red Army's sacrifices that helped end the war, and feuding over who the real fascists are now. Well, when Ukraine's ambassador to Germany, Andriy Melnyk, arrived, pro-Putin protesters shouted Nazis out and Melnyk out. And that follows the official Russian line that its special operation, quote-unquote, in Ukraine is a condition, or rather a continuation of its fight with liberated Germany from Nazism. I'm supporting the right people, one woman advised Deutsche Welle, who refused to say her name or where she was from, except far away. Quote, unquote. The red carnations in her hand, a common flower among Russia sympathizers, and her standing on the pro-Putin side of the crowd suggested where her loyalties lay. In response, Ukraine supporters chanted Slava Ukraini, a victory to Ukraine, which has become a rallying cry in the war, and says Mariupol. While Berlin's government restricted the display of both sides' flags and other national symbols to official events only, Ukraine's colors among protesters came out in other forms such as clothing and dyed hair. It's sad that even in Germany, there are some people who buy into Putin's propaganda, said Kaspar Kado, a 29-year-old Russian who lives in Berlin. Holding up a sign that reads, "It's happening again," quote unquote, he said that Ukrainians being driven from their homes reminds him of German troops sending his grandmother to Germany for forced labor in World War II. When I was growing up in Russia, there was a narrative about never again, quote unquote, when talking about World War II, he said, Putin brought back these terrible war crimes. I feel betrayed. Well, thousands of Soviet soldiers are buried in Tiergarten, not far from the Brandenburg Gate and the German Parliament. Today, the area is a favorite spot for walking tours and peaceful strolls through greenery and long, wide boulevards. In 1945, it was witness to a brutal final battle whose scars remain visible as bullet holes in building facades. I was there. Germany is obligated to maintain sites like these as part of an agreement to Russia withdrawing its troops in the early 1990s. The Soviet Union had just collapsed and power was transferred to the new Russian Federation. Other parts of the Soviet Union, such as Ukraine, feel their sacrifices have been erased from history. They're trying to say that only Russia defeated the Nazis, and this is not true, said Natalia, who declined to give her last name for security reasons. Something as simple as a year can be politically charged, while Soviet memorials, such as the one in the Tiergarten, often bookmark the war between 1941 and 1945. For other European, Eastern Europeans, the state of terror and oppression started with the Nazis in 1939 and continued with the Soviets after 1945. For Natalia, seeing Ukrainian flags fly in a memorial typically associated with Russia was an appropriate course of correction in how the history is remembered. As a 24-year-old activist from Kyiv who said she was studying in the eastern German city of Leipzig, my uncle was from Leipzig, when the war started, wants to challenge Germany's understanding of whom the country owes for ending the Nazi dictatorship. You can't go around Berlin and see quotations from Hitler, but you can go to Treptower Park and see quotes from Stalin. And everybody knows how many evils Stalin created for his own people in Soviet times, she said. She's referring to another Soviet burial site, Kumm Memorial, the largest in Germany, built in Berlin's eastern Treptow district shortly after the war. The sprawling, symmetrical complex leads to a 12-meter, it's about a 40-foot, a tall bronze statue atop a grassy mound, a Soviet soldier holding a child in one arm and in the other a sword smashing a swastika. On Monday, as they do every May 9, pro-Russian, far-left, and anti-Western associations gathered to pay their respects, along with representatives of foreign countries, mostly former Soviet republics and their guests. Hundreds of people lined up to climb to the statue, where flowers and messages of thanks to the Red Army piled up. For some there, World War II is literally not over. They claim that Germany never officially surrendered and fascism still runs rampant in the form of Western capitalism. And that bleeds into the Kremlin's view of the war in Ukraine, which sees it as provoked by American imperialism and NATO's eastward expansion. Quote, we drove out the fascists from East Germany, but they reconstituted themselves in the West, said Uta, an 80-year-old activist from Eastern Germany who declined to give her full name. Germany's Zeitenwende, the policy paradigm change which Chancellor Olaf Scholz declared in response to Russia's invasion in February, does not go down well with many in the crowd. New spending for Germany's armed forces and sending weapons to Ukraine to do battle with Russia is evidence of history repeating itself. If Russia loses, that just can't happen, Uta had said. They are truly against fascism and militarism. It's very, very interesting how all this turns around. It's a rewrite of so much of history. But what are you going to do when you have a society that doesn't have much freedom and opinion is one-sided? Now, bear with me a second. And this is really very interesting because who would have thought that this would continue? But the destruction in Mykolaiv after Ukraine blocks the after Ukraine is blocking Russian advances. The southern Ukrainian city of Mykolaiv has been plagued by bombing and shelling since the war began, and now the city is blocking a Russian advance toward Odessa. So we're going to see where that all goes, because I'm not quite exactly sure where that's going to go. Seems that many Ukrainians are leaving Odessa. For those still in the city, a curfew has been imposed as fears of attacks by Russia grow. So these are becoming really, really big issues. Now, let me just quickly see what else we can look at for you here. And yeah, it seems that Ukraine's Zelensky says that 8 people have been killed in a Russian missile strike in the southern city of Odessa. Meanwhile, an attempt to evacuate civilians from Mariupol appears to have failed. And Ukraine says 8 people have been killed in Russian strikes in Odessa. Mariupol officials say a push to evacuate civilians has failed. Zelensky is to host Blinken and Austin in Kyiv on Sunday. And United Nations says 5.2 million people are displaced by the Russian invasion. Zelensky vows to bring to justice all those responsible for Russian missile terror. In his late-night address on Saturday, our Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky spoke about the Russian missile attack on Odessa, which killed 8 people and wounded at least 18. Among those killed was a 3-month-old baby girl. How did he threaten Russia? It seems that killing children is just a new national idea of the Russian Federation, Ukrainian president had said. Zelensky also vowed to bring to justice all those responsible for Russian missile terror. Quote, we will identify all those responsible for this strike. No one will be able to hide, no matter how long it takes us. All of these bastards will be responsible for every death they caused, he said. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, said on Saturday it was trying to secure the release of some special monitoring mission, SMM staff members, who had been detained in eastern Ukraine. The OSCE is extremely concerned that a number of SMM national mission members have been deprived of their liberty in Donetsk and Luhansk. The OSCE is using all available channels to facilitate the release of its staff, the media office said on Twitter. On Friday, Britain's deputy ambassador for the OSCE, Deirdre Brown, criticized Russia for refusing to extend the SMM's mission in Ukraine beyond March. And now we have received alarming reports that Russia's proxies in Donbass are threatening mission staff, equipment, and premises, and that Russian forces have taken SMM staff members captive, Brown said in the address. After Moscow launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February of 24, the OSCE said in March it had evacuated nearly 500 international mission members from the country. As of April 1, the SMM has moved to an administrative role to ensure the safety and security of mission members and assets throughout Ukraine, including in areas not under government control, the OSCE media office said on Saturday. The SMM was deployed in March of 2014 following a request by the OSCE by Ukraine's government and a consensus decision by all 57 OSCE participating states. It was an unarmed civilian mission whose main tasks were to mentor and report on the situation in Ukraine impartially and objectively. So this continues and continues and continues. It's just truly amazing. Bear with me a moment here. Okay, bear with me. Okay. Well, evidently the United States, the U.S. is set to approve $40 billion for Ukraine, warning of a long war ahead. U.S. lawmakers were set to begin debate today on a nearly $40 billion aid package for Ukraine as Washington warned that Russia was likely girding for a long conflict with its neighbor. The defense, humanitarian, and economic funding should pass comfortably, with the two parties having reached an agreement on the details and will likely move quickly through Congress. This is a large package, but the need is great and time is of the essence. The president has called on both chambers of Congress to act quickly on the Ukrainian aid package, so act quickly we must. Chuck Schumer, who leads the Senate Democratic majority, said on the floor, congressional leaders struck a deal on Monday to release $6.8 billion more than the $33 billion previously requested by the White House to help the Eastern European nation ward off Moscow's invasion. The financial boost would include an extra $3.4 billion for both military and humanitarian assistance on top of the funding requested by the administration. If the package passes as planned, United States spending to bolster Ukraine's defenses against Russia's invasion and address the ensuing humanitarian crisis will soar to around $54 billion. The action comes as a top U.S. official warned that Russian President Vladimir Putin is preparing for a long war that may not end with Russian victory in the East. We assess President Putin is preparing for prolonged conflict in Ukraine, during which he still intends to achieve goals beyond the Donbass, the director of national intelligence, Avril Haines, said at a hearing on Capitol Hill. She added that Putin was counting on U.S. and European Union resolve to weaken as the conflict continues to cause food shortage and inflation, including spiraling energy prices. Debate and a vote on the legislation is expected in the House as early as Tuesday, that's today, likely followed by the Senate at the end of the week or next week. The Democratic leadership had hoped to tie the Ukraine money to a new round of funding for COVID-19 tests, therapeutics, and vaccines, with the United States experiencing a new spike in cases as it nears 1 million deaths. but they decided against the move as they were unwilling to get drawn into another fight over border control, the issue that sanks the previous attempt at a COVID funding deal before Easter. Now, House Democratic leaders are pushing for nearly $20 billion in additional pandemic preparedness funding in line with what the White House said it needs. The Senate has been considering a narrower package worth around $10 billion. Republicans stopped the COVID aid package last month, demanding an amendment vote to keep in place Title 42, the pandemic-related provision used to deny asylum requests and allow the quick expulsion of migrants. With the policy due to end on May 23rd, Democrats are reluctant to allow a vote as several of their moderate lawmakers and those in tough re-election fights would likely vote with Republicans. President Joe Biden said in a statement on Monday that he was prepared to accept a decoupling of Ukraine and COVID aid with approximately 10 days to go until the current funding runs out. Biden signed into law the creation of a lend-lease program on Monday that will make it easier for the United States to send military equipment to Ukraine more than 80 years after a similar program began America's involvement in World War II. So it's going to be very, very interesting. Now, let's just look at something else here. And this is really quite interesting. There's an historic coalition which marks the changing of the guard for the French left ahead of legislative elections. France's socialist, green, communist, and far-left parties have joined forces in an unlikely but historic alliance ahead of legislative elections on June 12 and 19. After a first-round presidential election that saw far-left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon fall just short of a place in the final, France's reinvigorated left wing has set its sights on winning a lower house majority, with Mélenchon eyeing the post of prime minister. After days of sometimes heated debate, France's leftist foes buried the hatchet last week, agreeing on a leftist coalition ahead of June's parliamentary polls. The Greens, the European Ecologie, Les Verts, or EELV, the French Communist Party, the PCF, and the Socialist Party all signed off on a May 4 accord with Jean-Luc Mélenchon's La France Insoumise, or France Unbowed, or LFI, with only the Trotskyites or Trotskyists, a new anti-capitalist party, the NPA, begging off from the deal. Well, the agreement sets out a joint slate of campaign proposals and apportions shares of constitutional nominations to all the allied parties who have pledged to field a single coalition candidate in each of France's 577 legislative districts next month. The deal marks the first time in 25 years that the French left has become or has come together to contest the first round of the legislative elections in lockstep. In 1997, the so-called plural left joined forces to win a legislative majority, elevating socialist heavyweight Lionel Jospin to the post of prime minister for 5 years, while conservative rival Jacques Chirac held the French presidency, a power-sharing scenario known in France as cohabitation, or cohabitation. Well, next month's election results will decide how the history books treat this new leftist coalition. Opponents are already eager to liken it to previous iterations. The Popular Front of 1936, for one, is still remembered fondly as a fount of social progress, including paid vacation and the 40-hour work week, down from 48, under leader Léon Blum. The Common Program of 1972, another leftist meeting of the minds, proved fundamental to socialist François Mitterrand's rise to the Élysée Palace 9 years later. And the next chapter for 2022's leftist bloc has yet to be written, but the degree to which any union seemed unthinkable just 3 weeks ago has lent it the luster of history in the making. So ahead of April's presidential election, Mélenchon's main leftist rivals, the Green candidate Yannick Jadot and socialist candidate Anne Hidalgo, were scathing on the campaign trail. As Russia invaded Ukraine, Jadot accused Mélenchon of obliging Vladimir Putin. Hidalgo, meanwhile, went so far as to label the charismatic far-leftist an agent, an ally, and a supporter of the Kremlin strongman. But the presidential election's April 10 first round had the effect of clarifying the balance of power on the French left. Mélenchon parlayed a mixture of genuine voter conviction and a persuasive pitch for tactical voting into a almost 22% score at the ballot box, just 422,000 votes behind far-left leader Marine Le Pen, who won a place in the April 24 final duel against Emmanuel Macron. Now, Mélenchon's relative triumph relegated the other leftist forces to also rams. The Greens' Jadot scored a mere under 5%, the communist candidate Fabien Roussel 2.25%, and Paris Mayor Hidalgo of the once mighty Socialist Party garnered a miserly under 2% of the vote. And those scores established Mélenchon and his La France Insoumise Party as the pivotal force of France's left wing, a kind of sweet political revenge for Mélenchon himself, a former socialist who struck out on his own in 2008, not least over disagreements with the party brass. So we're seeing a new dynamic that's happening in France, though we'll see where all that goes. It's going to be very, very compelling, so we'll have to follow that up for quite a while. And I guess that's about it. I think that's the end of our time. We've only got a few minutes left. So what we're going to do is simply just wish you a good day and thank you for being with us today. And hopefully you'll be able to join us tomorrow, Wednesday. What do we have on Wednesday? I'm not quite sure, actually. Let me look at the calendar. I don't know who's on for tomorrow. Oh, 1 sec. Tomorrow's the 11th. Tomorrow, I see we don't have anyone scheduled, which is perfect because I am literally falling behind with so much work to do. So we're not going to be doing a broadcast tomorrow at all. And we'll just leave it at that. And so you'll have a chance to rest up and we'll go from there. So all the best. Let me get back to our studio screen. And just wish you a good day. And thank you. Goodbye.